The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to today's show. We are starting a few minutes late here, so I apologize, but we are live right now. If you're listening at about 3:39 p.m. Monday, January 29th, that is, 3:39 p.m. Mountain Time. We are live in studio. If you have a question, please give us a call, 970-530-0556. We do have some email questions from people that we'll get to in the meantime, but if you have a question you'd like to interact with us live here on the show, we're more than happy to take your call. Once again, that's 970-530-0556, and we'll put you at the head of the line if you call in. Jim is frantically going through our pile of emails that we've got. We have a never-ending stream, it seems, of emails. We're putting a pretty good dent in it every week, so at some point maybe we'll get a little caught up. But right now I don't think the wait time is really that long, actually, on email responses. But the one way to bypass that email delay, if you will, is to call into the show live, 970-530-0556. So, Jim, are you ready?
Yes.
Perfect.
Do we have a caller?
We don't. She sent them away. They'll be back, apparently.
She sent them away?
Yeah.
Why?
Not sure.
Well, we can. She being Laura?
Yeah.
Okay. Laura is a wonderful woman who answers our phones, but we thought we had a caller. If the caller is still there and wants to call back.
Looks like they're coming in right now.
Perfect.
So let me.
Callers jump ahead of our email.
Yes. So, good afternoon. Is this Georgette on the phone?
This is.
Thank you for calling. So,
yeah.
We're using Georgette as the name to protect your anonymity, which is a word that we all know Jim has trouble with. But
anonymity.
Okay, that still sounds a little awkward, but...
But I did it.
But you did
I have been
so.
Practicing.
Very nice. So, thanks for calling into the show today, Georgette. What can we do for you?
Well, what state is she from?
I'm from Oregon, and I want to thank you for your podcast. I enjoy it.
Okay, we already have a star in Oregon, so we'll be hanging up. No.
Well, close. We do need Idaho. Are you sure? Are you close enough to Idaho you could drive across the border?
No, but I used to live in Montana, but I know you already have a
Yeah, we got Montana. Yeah.
Somehow Idaho's the holdout. Idaho and Nevada, which are two bordering states to Oregon. So if you ever plan a trip there, give us a call while you're there.
Well, I plan hopefully on retiring to Nevada or Colorado. So.
Oh.
So there you go.
There nice. You go. Nice. But what is your question, Georgette?
So I'm a do-it-yourself investor, mm-hmm. and I have written my own investment plan. Plus, I have written a money binder, which, if you want, I can explain what I did with that. But I was wondering if you have any guidelines to writing an investment plan, and I'm 3 to 5 years away from retiring.
When you say an investment plan, are you thinking more of like an investment policy statement?
No, I'm thinking about more geared towards retirement, you know, what I plan to do. I have all that in writing, and I just wondered if you kind of had a bucket investment plan for retirees.
We do as a
parent.
We do as a firm, Georgette, and we've talked about this on the show, believe in bucketing when someone enters the distribution phase. When you retire, are you going to be in the distribution phase? In other words, are you going to be consuming from your portfolio, or are you going to have Social Security, pension, and annuity that's providing a lot of your income or part-time income? In other words, are you going to be consuming assets or still accumulating assets?
Well, I can be fairly flexible with that. I have a pension through the state, and I also have a Roth IRA, and I have a 457B and another defined contribution plan. So I can be pretty I don't live very expensively, and I'll be selling my house in a couple years, and I have it paid off. So I mean, I can live most likely on my pension, and I'll be in when the market's down. I won't take probably hardly anything or anything from the IRAs, but when the market's up, I'll take a little bit more. And I already have, you know, a percentage that I would like to use as well.
Mm-hmm. And in your
account.
In your government job, did you participate in the Social Security system, or are you outside of the Social Security system?
I did participate, and I'm going to wait till at least 67 and a half, if not 70, to start taking Social Security.
Okay.
And I have all that written in my investment plan, mm-hmm. plus totals and, you know, how much I'll be getting in pension, how much I'll be getting in Social Security at different dates. I was just wondering if how you go about for a soon-to-be or a retiree, how you go about writing a retirement investment plan and maybe some of the things that I might be missing in my plan.
Well, again, we look when we work with people. Let's just assume you did a plan similar to the way we approach retirement. So you're probably very familiar with our minimum dignity floor concept. We believe that there's a series of expenses that you're going to have to cover for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. So hopefully you've put that plan into place to look at those expenses, isolate them, give them appropriate rates of inflation, because they tend to be expenses that go up far higher than any COLA adjustments. Your Oregonian... Is it Oregonian or Oregon? Oregon, your state of Oregon pension is going to pay you. They go up at rates far higher than any type of COLA adjustment to Social Security. So we really want a good understanding in our opinion, and you're calling for our opinion, but we like to get what that minimum dignity floor is, and then start putting your overlaying that minimum dignity floor, overlay it with your projected Social Security benefits at 67 and a half or 70, whatever age you think is closest to the age you're going to claim at. Overlay it with your pension income and overlay it with any Social Security income. All three of those adjusted for reasonable cost of living adjustments that they're eligible to receive. So you can get a picture and see, am I going to have enough secure income, lifetime guaranteed income to take care of me no matter how long I live? Because, Georgette, no matter how much you enjoy being a do-it-yourselfer right now and writing all this down and keeping track of it, as you age, like hearing this or not, As you age, the part of your brain that understands and comprehends financial concepts begins to degrade. We talk all the time about the Harvard study that shows that, and anybody who has parents who are in their 80s and 90s know this. I have plenty of clients in their 80s and 90s. My own dad is in his 80s, and he admitted to me last year he does not understand fractions. I was talking to him in fractions, and he was very embarrassed, but he admitted to me, "Son," he said, "I don't understand fractions." And this is the man. Is that my phone?
It is.
Oh, look at that. On live radio.
Even after I reminded you to mute your phone.
It's the people who are trying to repair my lamp. But even though my dad is the one who taught me math, he doesn't understand fractions anymore. So what I often say retirement planning is, Georgette, is the younger you putting in place a plan to take care of the older you. And it shouldn't just involve investing. You either have it or you don't. So we personally believe in maintaining that minimum dignity floor. Let's just assume you do that. And you have, and it'll help answer your questions too. What age should I claim Social Security? When should you turn on your state pension? Does your pension continue to increase the longer you wait, or are you better off turning it on now because it's not going to go up anymore? These are some of the things.
May I jump in there?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I've already done those things.
Good.
I mean, I've already figured those out. And the money binder that I put together is for my daughter. So when I become and able to manage my finances, that she can take them over.
And assuming she can do well. It's just our opinion as a firm and on our podcast, we believe that the minimum dignity floor should not be left to variations in the market. We feel Social Security, pension, and income annuity should cover it. So let's just assume, we'll take that off the table, you've done that. Your minimum dignity floor is protected. Now all's what you're trying to decide is how much should you spend on the fun things in retirement. Because if your minimum dignity floor is protected and you've covered everything, then all's what you're really trying to do is cover the fun things. And here's where I personally, and it's not just me, there's many advisors who take my approach to it. Wade Fow is one of them, and he's not even an advisor. He's a researcher in our industry, just came out with a new book. You may want to read his new book. The bucketing strategy of which you're talking and a lot of other distribution strategies. And he's pointing out in his new book that one of the fallacies of a safe withdrawal rate and how much to survive on or live on early in retirement forces people initially in retirement to unnecessarily spend too little early in retirement and not enjoy themselves, because as you age and get older, you're going to start doing less and less naturally because you're getting older. But if you're trying to survive on just a safe withdrawal rate, his new book is pointing out, rightfully so, this is something I've been preaching for years, you unnecessarily spend too conservatively. And that's where a sound bucketing plan comes in. Wade just gave a big seminar today that Justin attended. I was with a client, couldn't attend it, online on his new theories and concepts. So I would strongly suggest you read his book. A lot of the information in his book may help you as you work on your own bucketing plan. But again, assuming that what you're trying to do, Georgette, is satisfy your desired spending for now for the rest of your life, and you've taken care of your minimum dignity floor and your income needs, we believe that you should probably have 1 to 2 years of spending in cash. That's our first bucket. Your second bucket, depending on how you do your investments, you're a do-it-yourselfer, you're probably very good, low costs at Vanguard. Start switching to dividends and income-producing portfolios more than capital appreciation only. Start getting some dividends and income from your portfolio. Have them set to automatically feed into your cash bucket and try to make some projections of what the income you're going to be able to generate from those investments will be. And you might be able to put 1 or 2 years actual cash in your bucket one, but your investment bucket, which we call bucket three, might be feeding in half or all of subsequent years' income needs. So your investment pool is starting to support some of your spending. Remember, this is only desired spending I'm talking. In my strategy, all your required expenses are fully covered by your pension, Social Security, and income annuity if you needed any. Then your bucket two, Wade believes bucket two can be bond ladders or bond funds. We tend to say bond ladders are a little hard for most investors to do, but you're a do-it-yourselfer, so maybe you understand them. But bucket two, in Wade's opinion, can be anywhere from 3 to 7 or 8 years worth of expenses combined with your bucket one together should, in his opinion, maybe equal 5 to 7 years. We often say here in the office 8 to 10 years. It's really going to be up to the client. I think you would agree, Chris, there's no right or wrong answer of how much should be in bucket one or two. But he firmly believes, and so do we, your investment bucket, once you designed this, especially if you're using bonds or fixed annuities or laddered CDs in your bucket too, your investments can be predominantly equities. He says a very strong allocation of equities, because if you can have, in his opinion, 5 to 7 years of money in essentially it's a reserve pool is what you're doing. We feel 8 to 10 is a little better, but we tend to be on the side of caution in our office more. But your actual investment pool itself should be very equity centric.
And that's generally because there historically there's really been no better protection from inflation than equities. So the long-term risk, or one of the long-term risks, is having your lifestyle erode as your investments don't keep up with inflation. So having that long-term bucket out there invested in something that will keep pace or generally beat inflation is the best way to go.
Okay. Well, I've already done that. I have three buckets.
I don't know what you're looking for then, if you've done everything.
I just wondered if there was anything that I'm overlooking. I guess that's what I'm asking.
I would say anything? A few things if you're concentrating just on those. You know, if you've got all that handled, people will generally underestimate their exposures to certain risks, like medical expenses or long-term care risks. You want to make sure that you've got good protection there. On those aspects, make sure you've clearly identified other what I call hard constraints, which are if you have very hard specific goals for the future, make sure those are handled specifically in your plan, such as you mentioned you had a child. If you want to make sure that there's X amount there for an inheritance, or you've got a commitment to providing X amount for charities, those types of things, make sure those are handled in the plan. But scariest thing, I think, from your side, it sounds like your normal living expenses and your ability to do things in retirement are handled pretty well in your plan. Don't let a surprise event, mostly a medical issue or a long-term care issue, derail the whole thing. So make absolutely sure that you've got some good protections there.
Will both of you consider for yourself long-term, what is it called?
Long-term care insurance?
Yeah, for like if you go into a nursing home. Are you going to do that for yourself, or is that something that you've already have another way to pay for it?
Well, it is something that I will be considering. Most people purchase long-term care insurance between the age of 52 and 64. I'm 54, so I'm just entering now the age at which I'm going to start considering long-term care insurance within my plan. There's some unique aspects. You got to understand, when you put a long-term care insurance plan in place, it encompasses three elements. It's not just insurance. It begins with how much can you self-insure. So that's the first thing we have to look at. And especially with our approach to secure income and our belief in pension, Social Security, and annuities, this income can go to any expense. And if you are in a facility now, you're in some sort of assisted care facility or CCR, continuing care retirement community. These are the new structures being built with almost like a college campus. You enter, you have your own townhome in them, and as you age, you progress through people coming to your house to take care of you, to going into assisted living, to going into a full-blown nursing home, but you're staying in almost a college campus surrounding. But what the first thing you have to look at is how much are you going to be able to self-insure? Where are you going to grow old? Will it be in Oregon? Will it be in another state? If you're in Alaska, I know you're not, but we have listeners in Alaska. It's the most expensive state for long-term care, over $200,000 a year for a nursing home. If you're in Kansas, it's the cheapest at a little over $45,000 a year. So we have to look at where you're going to ultimately retire to, what are the costs in that state going to be, and how much can you self-insure? So once again, we have to either project out the value of your investments, less any spending you're going to do from them, or we have to look at your secure income. If you're not using your secure income to stay in your own home, that secure income doesn't stop, it continues. So we now can apply all of it towards staying into a retirement community. And that's income that you're going to receive in your 80s and 90s when you're going to have difficulty managing your portfolio. And that income just continues to come. So self-insure is the first part. Then we look at how much risk do we have to transfer to an insurance company, if any, and how is it going to be, or who is it going to be paid to? Some people say, oh, my children will take care of me. Others say, God, my children live all over the country. Or my children have their own children. How are they going to take care of me? Or some say, I don't want my child to be the one who's showering me and wiping me, because that's what long-term care is. And I don't want to put my child through that. I want to make sure I can hire someone. But it's very important on how you want to pay for it, because some long-term care insurance policies will not pay for family members because they're not licensed caregivers. Others will provide cash, they call indemnity plans, and they will provide cash for you to hire family members or neighbors or friends, or to pay your spouse to take care of you, so to speak. It could be you're married and you need help and your spouse is providing it. The insurance company will actually pay money for that care. So once we determine how much you can self-insure, we then have to look at where are you going to grow old and what are the costs. Subtract the two, that's the deficit. Is that deficit coverable with assets? If you're going to self-insure that, Georgette, you must take that money, that investment money, and put it off to the side. You cannot spend it. So that money comes out of your fund account. Well, when people start to see the hundreds of thousands of dollars they sometimes have to reserve, they say, well, wait a minute, that's going to affect a lot of my fun. Well, instead of putting $100,000 or $200,000 aside, you might want to put $2,000 a year or $3,000 a year or $5,000 a year into a long-term care insurance policy to make up the difference between what you can cover and what you can't cover. And then we have to design a policy to make sure if you want your children, family, or friends, or spouse to take care of you, the payments being made will be applied to that. Most long-term care insurance is what is called a reimbursement policy. They're only going to reimburse a licensed caregiver or service provider. They're not going to reimburse family, friends, and spouses. So we have to then analyze that and make sure we put the correct policy in place. And then the third element, so first element is self-insurance, second element is transfer of risk, third element,
the legal documents. It's one thing to say, I have this document you created with some service. That's not a legal document. If your daughter is going to take over your investments, you have to give her a power of attorney. You have to make sure that power of attorney form is reaffirmed every year by you. You have to make sure all the custodians will accept and acknowledge that power of attorney form, because the last thing you want your daughter to have to do is to go to conservatorship to be able to take over your asset management for you, because that will get the state involved and that just bogs everything down in the court. So those are the three elements of a sound long-term care plan.
Right.
Okay, that's some good information. So in lieu of a long-term care plan, I was thinking, well, I was going to, when I retire, start a health savings plan. I can't start it now because I don't have a high deductible health insurance policy. But how does that generally work for people in lieu of long-term care to have a health savings plan?
Well, it doesn't provide any leverage. An HSA is just
too long to fill up.
It's just a savings account, and you're only going to be allowed to put money in until age 65. Once you enroll in Medicare, you can't put money in an HSA anymore. Are you single or married?
Single.
Okay, so you can put it's a little over $3,000 a year. I forget the limit. I should know because I put mine in every year. Mm-hmm. But it's a little over $3,000 a year. It might be $3,500 something a year. You can put that in an HSA account, assuming you have a high deductible plan. And yes, you can put that money in and deduct it on your taxes and invest it. And then that money may be able to take care of you if you need long-term care in 20 or 30 years. But I highly doubt, how old are you today?
55.
I highly doubt putting in $3,000 a year for 10 years or $3,500 a year for 10 years is going to grow to enough where you're going to be able to even buy 6 months, let alone maybe 3 years, the typical length of a LTC need. That's the difficulty. And you're not passing the risk on, you're self-insuring. So that goes under some of your self-insuring pool. There's nothing wrong with self-insuring some, and that's why we always use Social Security, pension, and annuity as self-insurance, because the worst-case scenario is you're in full-time assisted living or a nursing home where you have no housing expenses anymore. Everything is provided for you in these communities, from your food to your housing to your medical care, not medical care that a hospital provides, but that a facility provides. So all or most of your Social Security, pension, and annuity goes to that. We can then say, okay, the HSA is going to sit here off to the side. There's no RMDs from it, so you don't have to worry about that. And we're only going to use it for long-term care. I don't know how big that account is going to grow to, but assuming you were to put $3,500 or whatever the limit is every year for 10 years, that's still $35,000 in the account, Chris, after 10 years. How big is that going to grow, and will it be able to take care of all your needs? I doubt it. So it should go into the self-insure pool without a doubt. I just don't know if it's going to grow to as much. And if the question came down to, Jim, I can only afford to put $3,500 in my HSA or $3,500 into a long-term care insurance plan, I would go on the side of the LTC plan. Because the LTC is going to leverage. The idea with insurance is to ensure low probability of risk, high cost events. You can self-insure probably 6 months or a year and a half of your long-term care. Sometimes 2 years of your long-term care. It's what would happen if something like my Uncle Benny, who has Alzheimer's and has had it for 6 years and will probably have it for another 4, 5, or 6 years before he unfortunately passes. But that is going to be over a decade of expenses that have been trying his family. You're trying to insure from those types of risks, not a 6 month or a 12 month or a year, 18 month risk, but for the longer risk.
Right. And there are certain, that $3,500 he mentioned, there are certain types of LTC policies that have a built-in feature that if you end up not using them, when you pass away, your beneficiaries can get any of that unused money
the
back.
Premiums back.
The premiums back. So there are, you know, if you're hesitant to start putting, because one way of, when you're putting money aside in your own account, in the back of your mind, I'm sure you think, well, it's always mine. If I don't use it, I get to keep it. Where if I pay premiums to an insurance policy, those are going to be, that's money gone that could have gone to my daughter or what have you. So the, so there are some options there that make it a little more digestible.
But
if you're
the
hesitant.
One thing I will say, and we received a few email questions on LTC, so I will be spending more time on it on future shows. I tell people when they, because we offer this insurance to people who want it from us, and when we're closing on it, I tell them, I hope you never use this. I mean, I don't say at the end of the year, damn it, I didn't get cancer this year, and all my health insurance premiums went to waste. I hope I don't get anything, and the money I'm paying for my health insurance goes to waste. I hope my car doesn't get totaled, and my auto insurance goes to waste. I hope my home doesn't burn down, and my homeowner's insurance goes to waste. I don't personally want to pass away the last 3, 5, 10 years of my life like my Uncle Benny, or in a nursing home totally dependent on someone to wash and wipe me. I'd rather die. So I hope I never need it. But I have to make sure I have a plan in place in case I do need it, because I don't want to be in a Medicaid bed. I don't want to be a ward of the state. Lord only knows how much the state's going to be able to take care of me in 30 years. They're having trouble taking care of people today. So that's one of the reasons we encourage people to put a plan in place. But I often tell them, Chris, and most people purchase the policies that will give the money back, but you get less leverage dollar for LTC if you're going to give the premiums back. But they'll say, I'll take less coverage. I don't want to lose the premiums. To me, that's a red herring. I would rather get more coverage than worry if my beneficiaries can. I'm dead, so that money is gone. But every single year of my life that I've purchased insurance, that money is quote-unquote wasted. I don't think it's personally wasted because I was protected. I did get the protection. I don't want to file an insurance claim on anything. But keep that in mind as you evaluate long-term care insurance. The reason that these return of premium policies came out is insurance companies sent questionnaires out to people. Why don't you want to buy this, or what features would you want to see? And this was chosen by a lot of people as a neat feature to have. So insurance companies offer it really as a way to sell policies to these people who otherwise wouldn't purchase one. But you get less long-term care coverage in order to get your money back.
So do you have any good websites that compare long-term care plans of different
It's a little tough.
That's a little tough. You really need to find someone who is going to be able to work with you. You're a do-it-yourselfer, so the first thing I want to warn you of, or not warn you, but inform you of with the insurance industry, it does not matter if you buy your policy. I don't even know if there's a long-term care do-it-yourself website. It doesn't matter if you go to one of these websites, if there's one that exists. I know they exist for income annuities, and they make me laugh because it doesn't matter if you buy an income annuity from an online website or a person you know, an agent you know. It's the exact same annuity. There is no discount, no cut in cost. That's how insurance is sold. You buy term life insurance or permanent life insurance online, through a computer, or in front of an agent. It's the exact same policy. That's how insurance companies design it. So rather than trying to find a website, I would say try to find a person who actually understands, has no axe to grind, doesn't represent just one company, is going to represent many different companies, or would be willing, if they don't represent a certain company, to get an agent from that company involved in it as well and say, hey, if you like this company, let's get someone involved. But you need to find an agent or an advisor who's very knowledgeable on long-term care and is going to be able to explain everything that I've just tried to explain. And if Justin was here, who knows even more on long-term care than I do, he's the go-to guy in the office, he can point out even other factors that sometimes, hey, make sure we find out this on the policy or that. So to me, long-term care is not a type of insurance that lends itself very well to just going to a website, reading a few web pages, becoming a quote-unquote expert, and then buying it. It really should be something that you find from a good agent or a good advisor and understand it doesn't matter if you buy it from a website or from a person. Insurance is not the same as an investment. When you buy an investment through a robo-advisor or through Vanguard, they're known for low fees because they remove that middleman, that advisor who's going to take 1% or so of your assets. And what the advisor was doing, they've programmed a computer to do through algorithms. That can be a true savings. But right now, insurance is sold through a relationship and commission of the sale of the insurance policy is programmed right into the insurance premium. And it doesn't matter to the insurance company if the agent is a human or a computer, it's the same policy.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, there are certain things where trying to educate yourself is going to be way more work to become adept at it enough to make a wise decision compared to letting a professional help you. And this, I agree with Jim. I'm big on do-it-yourself. This is one area where probably your best investment of time is identifying a trustworthy, competent LTC expert rather than trying to become the expert yourself.
And you'll know. You're a smart woman. You're a do-it-yourselfer. You'll know if that agent is just trying to sell you something. If they're putting on the strong rush, oh, you got to buy now, or if the answer the minute you walk in is, oh, XYZ Insurance Company, hands down. And they haven't even listened to what you had to say. But if they're going to sit there, if they're going to talk to you and help you determine how much you can self-insure, how much needs to be transferred, if they're going to ask you, who's going to be taking care of you? How are we going to pay them? Gee, you need an indemnity policy to pay your child or your husband to take care of you or your neighbor. You need a reimbursement policy for these other expenses and try to work that. And these are all the questions and the time we spend with people, helping them determine what policy is going to be best for them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. And I just had one comment about last week's podcast, if I might.
Uh-huh. If I remember it.
Okay. Well, you had Barry James on, I think.
Oh, okay. Was that last week or was that the week before?
It was recently. We had him on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so being a female and being a buy and hold investor, I just thought, you know, it was pointing to market timing, and which is dangerous to you know, wait and hold some money in like a money market and wait and purchase rather than just having an investment plan and sticking with it and slowly, you know, as you get older, just being safer, you know, as far as taking risk. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was just my thought.
How that would be interpreted from him. And this is certainly an area where there's degrees of any of these approaches.
Mm-hmm.
Not to speak completely for Barry, but the vast majority of his holdings are going to be long-term hold value propositions. He's not jumping in and then jumping out with half of his money.
No, that's not how Barry does it. Yeah.
When we say have some powder dry off to the side, when markets are at their highs for long periods of time, it's inevitable, but that there's going to be a drawback. And having every dollar invested provides you with no opportunity to take advantage of things that might come up. But I totally get what you're saying. You have to be really careful not to let the emotions of that. And there's a lot of evidence that having a structured, reliable, regular investing approach and essentially ignoring short-term swings in the long haul can pay off just as well as trying to, you know, hold a little money off to the side and then put it in, et cetera. That's really going to come down to investment philosophy as much as anything, though.
Yeah, and you got to remember, Georgette, okay, Barry is an active manager. That's what you're paying for. So he has to build. He doesn't have to, but if you read his prospectus and his investment mandates, he can be up to 90% equities, and he'll tell you in the over 23 years his investment fund has been around, he's never been that high in equities. But he has the ability to be that high. Really what he strives for, and he freely tells people, in the last heyday crazy market of 08, just before that, in the 90s, he goes back to the internet bubble, he lost more clients, he'll tell you, during that time period because he felt these equities were overvalued. If you read his prospectus, he can't purchase equities if they're overvalued. And he lists his criteria of how they measure valuation. So he's saying, look, I can't buy them and I don't want to buy them. They're too expensive. So he'll tell you in 98 and 99 were his two toughest years, but they were the best years in the equity markets. He just felt everything was crazy overvalued. He built cash. His best period of time was the three-year bear market that followed, 2000, 2001, and 2002. And his performance was stellar, positive, when the equities were down over 50%. And it's because he didn't buy and just needlessly hold. That starts to get into, if he was here, it's when you put a buy and hold investor like yourself in front of an active investor like Barry, it causes, they're two totally different, it's like left and right, night and day, up and down.
Well, and also probably for an active investor, you have to have a lot more money to work with. And, you know, most of Americans can't do that. And so that's why I said that it can be dangerous to put that out there, because, you know, of the people that I talk to, and I've become really interested in finance, it's amazing how little people know and how little they want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why we're in business. Not if everyone was like you, we wouldn't be in business. If everyone was a do-it-yourselfer. I mean, Home Depot exists, but people still hire contractors because people realize there's certain things I can do on my own, and I'm going to go to Home Depot and buy that, but there's certain things I need a contractor or a builder for, and I'm going to let him or her do that for me. And retirement planning is no different. There's certain things that you're going to be able to do okay on your own, and there's certain things where you're going to be, this is way beyond my realm. I need a professional to help me with this. And that's where an investment firm like Barry comes in. But one thing I will warn you on is don't use accumulation rules for a distribution portfolio. You'll be killed by that. So make sure.
Oh, yeah, I definitely am getting safer as I approach retirement. And, you know, I have my bucket set up where, you know, like pretty much what you guys are doing. I have a cash bucket, and then I have another bucket that's just going to be an IRA. I could probably say Vanguard, which is going to be 50-50. And then I have a Roth IRA that will be just equities. So I have that kind of set up, and I think being a female, I at least the females that I've talked to have been a little bit more cautious in their approach to investing and saving than the males that I've talked to, and I don't know if that's a generality or
it's a genetic defect in males.
So
I will say this.
There's
a couple of people I work with where the female is far more aggressive than the husband. Absolutely. There's a handful, but they do exist where the female is much more aggressive than the husband. But generally speaking, yes, a big generalization, women tend to be a little more conservative with their assets than males. But anyways, you seem to be doing okay. You seem to be on track. Don't be afraid to reach out if we can help you with anything. Don't be afraid to reach out to professionals to help you on areas where you're just not going to be able to master it. But there's a lot to encompass in retirement planning. Investing, in my opinion, is some of the least important things to worry about in a sound retirement plan. We didn't even get into your tax planning window, if there's any conversion strategies, if what's going to happen when required minimum distributions begin. Are they going to push you into higher income tax brackets or not? What's going to happen when you pass away and someone inherits your assets? Is it going to spouses, non-spouse beneficiaries? What are they going to be dealing with? I mean, there are so many other aspects to retirement planning. Investing is just one small aspect of that. Even in my firm, investment management is just one small aspect of what we do. And again, we have Travis on board, a CFA who manages our models and watches that, because I'm too busy doing all the other things. And investing is just one small aspect. What I tell people, it sometimes is the least important, especially when you first retire, because you either get the money or you don't. Investing isn't going to magically allow you to retire. You either have enough assets or you don't. How to spend assets is far more complex than how to accumulate them, especially because you're aging and every year, like it or not, some of your brain that understands these concepts is degrading. So just keep that in mind, but I think you seem competent and, mm-hmm. and on track, so we feel happy for that.
Yeah, and Georgette, you're asking all the right questions, so just keep doing that, and you're miles ahead of most people in that area.
Well, the idea from the money binder actually really helped, and I got mm-hmm. that from other podcasts, mm-hmm. you know, and I put that together. So that's really worth doing. If you are out there a do-it-yourself investor, I would highly recommend just putting together a money binder.
It helps clarify things. Even just the act of putting it together can help you understand more what you have and what and maybe identify areas where you may not have put enough thought or planning in place.
Yeah, and then like I said, my daughter is getting one of my money binders, and then mm-hmm. if I did pass away, she would have all the information that she needs.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
All right, Georgette, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your podcast, Jim and Chris, and good luck to you.
Okay, thanks
so
much.
Have a nice afternoon.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye.
Perfect. You know, one thing she pointed out, that how many people don't do this. Believe it or not, most people aren't like her.
They don't want to get into that level of detail. If they did, they would have, a lot of them would have chosen to do it as a profession if they're into it that much. But then you get I guess we'll call them aggressive hobbyists. You know, it's not their job, but they just feel very passionate about it and have a great interest in it. They really dig deep in it. And she may very well come up with a better plan for herself than any number of professionals might.
Absolutely.
There's no one way to do this.
No, that's what we've often told people, listeners. We did a whole show in the past, what to look for as you interview a retirement planner. And it's not these silly little questions, 10 questions to ask your financial planner that the CFP board puts out. That doesn't have anything to do with a retirement planner. I often tell people the first thing you should be asking them, what is your philosophy and why with retirement planning? How are you going to approach my retirement and why? Mm-hmm. It's not just how, it's why. Let them defend it. And we share all the time our thoughts and theory behind the minimum dignity floor.
And some people don't have that same philosophy or view, and they can't see themselves working in a situation like that. And so they go and do something else. There's quite a number of people that embrace our approach.
And I tell a prospect as I chat with them, either over the phone as a coffee and a second opinion phone call, because we do work with people throughout the country, or face-to-face in one of our Colorado offices. If my philosophy that I'm going to describe to you does not resonate with you, please don't hire us. because you're going to be sorely disappointed. This is the way we work. And I tell them, I'm not going to be hurt. I'm not going to go out of business if you don't hire me. I'm beyond that hump, Chris. Mm-hmm. Our business is doing fine. We have work. We have people who believe in our approach. Mm-hmm. But I tell them, if you do like our approach and it resonates, we'll probably work very well together and you'll be pleased with the results. And any advisor should tell you that. Well, Here's my approach.
The advisors that are comfortable with themselves and who they are will do that. It's where you get an advisor that's so desperate for your business that they'll say anything to make you happy.
If he's sticking a mirror under your nose and seeing if you're fogging it.
Right, right. So it's, you know, it's not possible for one firm to be experts at every approach and do it 13 different ways.
And do
it's
it
just
right,
not practical. You could do it messy. You could fly by the seat of your pants and make it seem like you're doing it 13 different ways. It's not going to work well.
No.
I can tell you that. So you need somebody you fit with and somebody who does it that way really, really well because that's all they do. They do it all the time. They're experts at doing it that way. And if that way aligns with what you want to do, it's match made in heaven, yeah, if you will.
We just, as a firm, don't believe in probability statistics and withdrawal percentages to base your entire retirement on. Mm-hmm. Not only because we feel, I would not go to a doctor who says, you have an 88% chance of surviving this operation with me. That's not high enough for me. I don't even know if I'd want a 90% chance. But if another doctor was to say, you have 100% chance, no doctor's ever going to say 100, but imagine if you could, you have 100% chance with me. I like that one better. And that just is my approach. But also how I got into retirement planning, buying strawberries for an elderly woman who couldn't afford them when I was in my early 30s. And I changed, it was like I parted the Red Sea for this woman. And I changed, I can't say I changed her life, she changed mine. But later when she shared with me in the parking lot that she couldn't afford strawberries and she's 78 years old, living on just Social Security, yeah, that got me thinking, this is what life is, this is what retirement is, and it helped us evolve our whole process. And I share people that story. This is how I got in front of you today. So I share this only because I believe in it so vehemently. But I think one of the hard things we have, Chris, is getting people to understand you are going to grow old. And I tell people, retirement isn't the beginning. It's the end. And we all know how this ends. We don't get younger, stronger, and healthier. And I warn people, you're going to grow weaker physically, you're going to grow weaker mentally, and you're going to grow weaker financially. And the idea of retirement planning is to have in place a plan. That's where you work with your medical doctor for the physical you growing older. You should be working with your family and your attorney and your financial planner on the mental you growing older. And then you work with a competent retirement planner on the financial you. And you can put in place a plan. As I say, the younger you, Georgette was 55. We work with most people who hire us between 50 and 70. But I'll tell them, it's the 55-year-old you, Georgette, on one end of the seesaw, and the 85-year-old you on the other end of the seesaw. And it's a give and take between the two of yous. That's what retirement planning is. But more importantly, it's putting in place a simple plan. Because Georgette is 55. We talked repeatedly, according to Harvard's study, the human brain is at its peak for understanding financial concepts at age 53. 53, she's 55. She's right there at the peak, just like I am. But I'm not naive. I know in 20 years, when I'm 74, I'm not going to know as much as I know today, and I'm not going to grasp the new concepts. And when you learn about what happens to our brains as we age, the ability to multitask starts going away. The ability to remember short-term concepts starts to go away. The ability to understand numbers and financial concepts does go away. My own father, Chris, when he admitted to me, it was in September of 2016, we were talking about the New England Patriots after their first win on the phone. I don't for the life of me know how I'm talking about Tom Brady and the New England Patriots, and I got on the subject of fractions. And I'm talking about the football games with fractions. If you could have heard the embarrassment in my dad's voice, because he had to stop me, and he said, "Son, I don't understand fractions anymore." He wasn't following what I was saying. And I just quickly said, "Dad, it's okay. That's what you have me for." I didn't know what the hell I was supposed to say. I was like, "Gee, you used to." I didn't say that to him. He doesn't listen to the show, so he doesn't know I'm saying this. But this is a true story. And I said, "It's okay." And he said to me, he said, "No, I used to understand them." And he said, "This started a few years ago." And he's 84 today. And it was his admission that he no longer understood it. And this is the man who taught me the multiplication tables. You know, when I grew up in the 70s, we had to study these tables. We didn't have calculators back then. So we had to do the multiplication tables. You had to learn geometry, algebra. He helped teach me all that. And here he is admitting at 84 he doesn't understand fractions. I have met with people who have hired me 10, 12 years ago who at first loved investing like Georgette does. And today in their 70s, they'll tell me right out, "I don't care about this anymore, Jim."
Right.
They don't.
And that's probably more my concern for Georgette, that you know, in the near term, over the next 10, 15 years, she probably still does, will maintain the mental capacity enough to manage this, worry about this, look at the buckets and make investment choices, all that kind of stuff. But it does get tedious over time. And maybe she'll have a love for it until she passes. I will say my own grandmother was, and she was one of the main reasons I got into finance in the first place. She was very interested, read parts of the Wall Street Journal every single day, right up until the very end. And that was just her thing. It was her, she wasn't a professional. She was an aggressive hobbyist, kind of like Georgette. You know, her passion for that kind of, fed me a little bit. And, but that's, not typical. That's typical.
When I used to work for a national firm, I won't name the firm, when I first moved to Colorado, folks, in 1999, I had no job. And the only place that would hire me, if I told you, you know the firm I used to work for, mm-hmm. I jokingly say, they'll hire anyone. When I first got hired, I thought I was special. I didn't know how the industry worked.
Yeah, they're pretty aggressive hiring students at CSU.
They would hire anybody.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh my God, this firm gave me a job. My God, this is great. I must be good." And then it was only later that I realized they'd give a job to anyone. It didn't matter. And if you stuck, great. If you didn't, no sweat off there. You know
what?
They moved on.
The old model.
That was the old model. And they used to ship us down from Northern Colorado to Denver. That's when the drive used to be easy 19 years ago. And they would ship us down there for training. And I remember on my way to my first training class, I was all excited, Chris, because I thought we were going to learn about something, an IRA, an investment strategy, a distribution. It was all these things I wanted to learn. It had nothing to do with that. It was all sales. And it was just a guy teaching us how to sell something when someone says no. The emotional tugs you need to put on someone. Talk about children or grandchildren. And it's not about them. It's about their kid. All this horrendous crap they would teach us. I hated it. Oh, my God, I hated it. But the one thing that stuck in my mind is one guy who told us this. And I have no idea, Chris, if his numbers are accurate or if he just pulled them out of thin air. But he said to us, he said, 15% of the population is going to be so apathetic, they're never going to hire you no matter what. 15% of the population are going to be do-it-yourselfers who feel they don't need any professional help. Something like Georgette, who just was on the phone. And I'm not saying she feels she doesn't need professional help, but she's definitely a do-it-yourselfer. He said the other 70% of the population hate what you do. They're just not interested in it at all, and they know they need help, and that's who you're going for. So I don't know if those statistics are right, but that was the only one that stuck in my head was that. I don't remember anything else that they said. But I would say anecdotally, I've been doing this now 19 years. This will be the beginning of my 19th year. I would say there are a good portion of people who, no matter what, they're never going to hire anyone. Their answer to retirement is, who cares? I'm going to work and then die. That's what they say. There's do-it-yourselfers, but remember, the business model of that firm 19 years ago was you didn't charge for your time. You had to sell a commission product. That's what they were doing back then.
So they couldn't touch those people.
They couldn't touch those people. Today, we work a lot with do-it-yourselfers. Mm-hmm. They're hiring us. They're going to pay us a fee. They want our advice. Hey, here's what I'm doing. What do you think? But I will agree there is a big chunk of the population, though, who, unlike Georgette, they know they need help, just like Georgette knows she needs help, but they have no desire to do it on their own. They don't want to go home and do the research and think and read. They're just looking for someone who, I want someone I can trust who knows what they're doing and can explain all these concepts to me. And so, again, we attract a lot of do-it-yourselfers because we have that a la carte, by-the-hour business model that they like. And they respect the fact that we're not going to try to grab their assets and manage them and jam them into products. So we can work with do-it-yourselfers, but I think the do-it-yourselfer community is much smaller. So Georgette's surprised that a lot of people don't do this. Georgette, it didn't surprise me at all. Being in this for 19 years, a lot of people just don't find any interest in your grandmother read the Wall Street Journal. Most people never even pick that paper up.
No.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps it up for this episode. What do you think?
I think so. It was right about the sweet spot.
So we didn't get any of these emails answered. So I apologize to our emailers, but Georgette proved if you simply call us, you get your question answered right away.
Yep.
And you can actually carry a conversation on with us as opposed to the emailers.
Right when Jim breathes, you can stick something in there.
That's a dig. I don't like that.
Your volume of words, your quantity can be overwhelming sometimes, so it's okay. People just want to fully frame their question at the front end, and then we'll work to let them speak a little bit more.
All right. Maybe you can kill my mic?
Well, not so much. That'd be a little aggressive.
Oh, before we go, we want to let our listeners know we're going to attach the Colorado show.
Yes.
It was a very good one. It was a good Colorado show. Mm-hmm. We talk about ways that the recent Republican tax bill will impact IRA planning. So that's about a 40-minute podcast that's going to be attached to the end of this podcast.
Right. If you're going to listen to the recorded podcast, if you're listening live today, here it's Monday, January 29th at about 4:38 p.m. Mountain Time. This podcast will be ending, but we'll have this up on our website on iTunes and on the website, jimhelps.com, where you can find that. Once you listen to it there in its pre-recorded form, you'll be able to listen to that Colorado show tagged on to the end of this. And if you have questions, remember the number for next week, 970-530-0556.
Right? 530-0556. Or Jim Helps, jimhelps.com.
See you next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556. Rocky Mountain High, Colorado. Rocky Mountain High, Colorado.
Well, welcome to this edition of the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado edition specifically. On today's show, we are going to discuss new IRA planning under the new tax rules that have recently been put into place. Is the 2018 Tax Cut and Something Act, something blah blah blah, that James Saulnier, who's with us in the studio today, will
Tax Cuts and Job Planning Act.
Job planning, that's what I always forget.
Of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It does not form a good acronym that can be spoken. It's TCJA. TCJA.
Oh, it's not terrible.
So this wouldn't be an acronym. It would be an initialism.
Correct.
For those who don't know, we solved that riddle, what, about 3-4 years ago now?
We did.
The difference between a acronym and a initialism. An acronym is when you actually pronounce the word like IRA, mm-hmm, for IRA. Whereas...
I don't like that one, by the way.
Do you have another one?
I just don't like IRA. I just don't like the way it sounds.
It's like a name. What if someone's name was IRA?
It's okay as a name. I just don't like it, in regard to my IRA.
Okay. Well, you can say IRA instead of IRA. Mm-hmm. You could say FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. We call them FINRA, or I affectionately call them the Evil Empire. But FINRA would be a acronym because you pronounce the actual letters, whereas FBI is an initialism.
Right.
Because you don't say FBI.
No, not normal people don't say FBI.
No. So it is the FBI. Mm-hmm. Well, the Tax Cut and Job Act of 2017, TCJA, is definitely an initialism because there is no way to even pronounce that acronym.
They must have let go the department that come the acronym department.
Yes, we jokingly talked about that department. It was probably the most,
because the government, the federal government in particular, is famous for these interesting acronyms that come out of everything.
For like everything.
DACA and all that stuff. Yeah.
But this is definitely not an acronym, TCJA, Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. But anyways, folks, we do want to welcome you to this week's edition of the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado version. Wherever possible, we're going to put a Colorado spin on our retirement and IRA advice. And today, IRAs are going to take center stage because we're going to talk about certain ways that IRA planning has been affected by the Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017, otherwise known as the Republican Tax Plan. It's just easier. We
should call it that. If people call it Obamacare,
call this the Republican Tax Plan.
Yeah. I mean, give credit where credit is due.
Correct.
Right.
So there are ways that this new tax law will impact your IRA and IRA planning. We're going to bring Justin on the show in the second half. He's going to talk a little bit about the kiddie tax again and how the kiddie tax under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act may actually impact what grandparents, Chris, do with their IRAs. So we're going to mention something that is very seldom spoken about, but something that we want to throw out there to get people thinking. But today's show, again, is going to involve IRA planning in the wake of the Republican tax cuts, and how are they going to impact the way you do planning with IRAs. I think one unique aspect that a lot of people haven't spoken about is under the Republican plan, the backdoor Roth contribution. Well, it's actually called a backdoor Roth conversion, which you and I have agreed it shouldn't
be. It's a bad name.
It's actually the backdoor Roth contribution. Because anyone can convert. You don't have to go through the backdoor.
Right.
So I don't know why they call it the backdoor Roth conversion.
I think those who call it that are being sloppy with their English.
It should be the backdoor Roth contribution.
Right.
There was a lot of argument in our field, mostly between financial planners like myself who wanted to plan and use that strategy, and tax preparers and CPAs who worried about the step doctrine rule
and how if you follow the step doctrine rule, which in a very simplistic manner, listeners, is a rule the government put in place that if you were to take a series of steps that in and of themselves, Chris, each step is probably perfectly legal and okay, but when done in order or in a string, you can arrive at an outcome that wouldn't normally be allowed. They call that the step doctrine rule, and what you are ultimately trying to do will be proven to be unallowable as well.
Right. So essentially, you can't go in the back door, is what the step doctrine rule says. If the front door is locked, you're not allowed to go around to the back, because then you'd get inside the house, which obviously the locked door was to prevent. So if you're trying to subvert that, so that's essentially, if we want to connect it to the back door phrase that we're talking about. So that's always been the
right.
The
a lot of tax preparers felt
that if you take advantage of the back door Roth conversion,
you're going to fall foul of this
contribution. You're going to violate that, and it's going to come back to haunt you or bite you. But we have clarification.
We have clarification on that, in the Republican tax bill, because prior to this clarification, some people would say Ed was one of them, Ed being Ed Slott of the Ed Slott Group, would often encourage us to tell our clients to convert the following year. Don't do it all at the same time. I never took that approach, and I used to tell our listeners and I told my clients, I think you can do it anytime you want, but if you want to be on the safe side, wait a month or wait to the following year to be even more certain. Wait a certain period of time before you convert. And for those who don't know how the back door worked or still works, when you make too much money, if you make too much money, you're not going to be allowed to contribute to a Roth IRA. But so long as you don't have any other IRAs, traditional IRAs, you can have Roth IRAs that you've opened when you could put money in, but let's say your earnings are at such a level where you can no longer put money in, assuming you don't have a traditional IRA, the whole idea of the backdoor strategy is you would put money into a non-deductible traditional IRA, and that's anybody, Bill Gates himself, or Warren Buffett, or whoever the richest man, Jeff Bezos now, right? Isn't he? He's got more money than God, doesn't he?
Well, several of them do, but
he's the king now, isn't he? Okay, so Jeff Bezos himself, who makes too much money, obviously running Amazon, to contribute money to a deductible IRA, can still put $5,500 or $6,500 into a non-deductible IRA, depending if he's over 50 or under. I think Jeff is over 50, but I'm not sure. So the whole idea of the back door is anybody can put money into a non-deductible IRA, so they put it in, and then they convert it to a Roth. Anyone of any income, Jeff Bezos himself again, can convert an IRA to a Roth IRA. So that is how the whole backdoor strategy works. If you have an existing IRA, though, the strategy doesn't work. I don't want to get into it, but it won't work. You have to have no IRAs. Now, we've had listeners to this podcast, Chris, reach out to us because of advice we've given. We've spoken many times. If you have an existing IRA, the conversion, the backdoor doesn't work. What you do is you take that existing IRA, transfer it into your current 401k, assuming they accept it, and most 401ks will accept it. You transfer that IRA into the 401k. Now you have no IRA and you can do the back door. Okay, so even though the Tax Cut and Job Act of 2017 did not come after or even pass any type of rule that impacted the back door, they specifically gave it two thumbs up, clean bill of health. They wrote, although an individual, and this is quoting from the Congressional Conference Report of the Tax Cut and Job Act, although an individual with adjusted gross income exceeding certain limits are not permitted to make a contribution directly to a Roth IRA, that individual can make a contribution to a traditional IRA and then convert that IRA to a Roth IRA. I don't think it gets any more explicit than that.
We essentially clarified their intent so that the IRS couldn't come back and through their own interpretation claim that it's not allowed, maybe due to the step doctrine issue, something like that. So somebody at least was sharp enough or allowed pressure to be put on, or someone's mentioned it to the Congress people. Can you insert this in there just so we can have clarification on this so that we don't have to worry about the IRS coming back on us on these things that we're doing anyway?
Right. And I never even knew that there was a congressional conference report that accompanies every law. But this is the congressional conference report on the Tax Cut and Job Act of 2017. And it effectively gives a de facto endorsement to the backdoor Roth contribution. I call it contribution. It goes by conversion. I don't know why. You're not going through the back door to convert. Anyone can convert. You're going through the back door to get the darn money in.
Right.
So to me, it's a backdoor Roth contribution. Call it whatever you want. For all our listeners out there, especially our CPA listeners who still think the step doctrine nullifies the ability to do this, it does not. And here is unmitigated proof. So that is one thing that the new law did.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of nice to kind of tidies things up. We had this bit of uncertainty out there, and they cleared it right up for us.
One thing it did do, though, is permanently ban Roth recharacterizations.
Yeah, they made that clear, but that's a bad thing. Taking away flexibility, essentially, is what's happened here. And we all know when you're... Everybody's individual financial situation is unique, and having as much flexibility to adapt your financial planning to your specific needs is very valuable. So when we are always adverse to any attempts to reduce the flexibility that people might have, and this is exactly what happened here.
So we've talked about this ad nauseum on the show several times, so I don't want to get into it too much. But a conversion in the past was essentially a redo, an undo. In fact, conversion is 19 letters. Undo was 4 letters. So we used to jokingly say...
Recharacterization.
Yeah. Sorry. Recharacterization is 19 letters, which is outrageously long. And undo is 4. And when you hear the word undo, you know what the heck that means. It means you can undo it. And that's essentially what a recharacterization was. If you recharacterized in, let's say, 2017, bad choice. You convert in 2018. Let's say that you convert this year. You used to have until October 15th of next year, October 15th of 2019, to change your mind, Chris, and move all or some, because you could do partial recharacterizations. Move all or some of the money back to an IRA as if it never happened. Now, this wasn't a loophole, Chris. This was the law. It was written into the law in 1998 when they created, actually 97, they created them, 98, they first came out January 98. This is the 20th year anniversary of Roth IRAs, and we're going to be spending a lot more time throughout the year talking about Roth IRAs. But Roth IRAs were always created with the ability to redo them.
And it's to give people flexibility.
There
wasn't
absolutely
a list of we're allowing you to do this for these specific reasons. If they intended it to be for just one specific reason, they would have written that in there. They didn't. They just said, if you want to undo it, you can, and these are the rules you need to follow. And there were a variety of reasons why people wanted to undo it. For some reason, there's some Congress people that got it in, you know, a bee in their bonnet, due to some lobbyists, I'm sure, or someone that only told them half the story.
I don't know who the lobbyist is, though. Just Grinch?
I would say it's got to be someone along the lines of, look, there's something that people who have money
can do
that other people can't. So that just inherent, there's got to be no reason for it. We've got to shut that door. I can't imagine any other reason for this, that it's something that there's a perception that it's a way to manipulate things by the rich, which there is one particular scenario that you might argue that's exactly what's going on. People trying to play games with timing of taxes, but it prevents all the legitimate reasons for undoing it. Like you changed your mind, or suddenly you realize you can't afford the taxes on that, and you have to undo the decision. And there's a variety of other reasons. It's not all about, gee, this is one thing we wish wasn't in there because it's just these rich people manipulating their taxes, and that's not fair. That was only a part of what this could be used for. And I would argue there's lots of things, that lots of rules that are out there that should still be fine and should still be allowed, even if there's a couple people that use it for their own personal benefit in a way that maybe it wasn't fully intended. But you don't just shut it off for everybody.
Yeah,
but
well,
in some cases they do, I guess. In this case, they did.
And they got rid of the ability to recharacterize. Okay, so recharacterizations, gone. Backdoor Roth conversions, what we call contributions, supported. Or, don't want to say extended, but definitely supported. They are perfectly legal. There is no reason anymore. I know we have a lot of listeners out there, especially off of iTunes. We call them affectionately iTunians. You do a lot of these backdoor Roth contribution strategies.
By the way, I had an email from an Androidian just this week.
Oh.
So they wanted to point out what I do, which is you don't have to listen through iTunes.
No. You can be an Androidian or an iTunian.
Right. So
now, do Androidians and iTunians get along, or do they attack each other when they see each other?
As far as I know, they usually play nice. When they're not around each other, I think they make fun of the other group, though.
But face-to-face,
face-to-face,
friendly.
They're usually friendly.
They're friendly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah. We're not going to have any Star Wars action going on
between
our iTunians and Androidians. What was the Androidian's email?
What was the email? The content of the email? It was a Social Security question.
Oh, are we going to answer it later?
No, because we're talking about IRAs and tax law.
But on another show.
Possibly on another show.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of a... Never mind. It was complex and unique to their situation, so I don't know if we'll do a full question, but we'll see.
Okay. So, disaster losses. This is something that can sometimes impact Coloradoans, especially if we have large forest fires, which we do every once in a while.
Or a tornado.
Or a flood. Mm-hmm. Every great once in a while. But our rivers here, which don't really receive a tremendous amount of rain all at once, sometimes get inundated when a massive cloud forms over the Rockies. We just had a big, big flood situation several years ago here in Colorado. So occasionally issues happen in Colorado where disaster areas are declared. And, of course, throughout the nation, disaster areas can be declared. But one thing that the Tax Cut and Job Act, otherwise known as the Republican Tax Plan, does do is it restricts now the deductibility of casualty and theft losses. It doesn't affect it if your area is declared a disaster area by mm-hmm. the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
But it does remove casualty and theft loss deduction if your area is not declared a disaster area. So you could still have a house burned down or 100 acres of the forest burned down and not a major fire mm-hmm. or a major flood. But it does remove the deductibility except... for losses resulting from a federally declared, disaster area. Now, it does carry over if you were already in this, so they have grandfathered people in, but beginning in 2018, there is no longer a deduction for casualty or loss. If you're robbed, there's no more deductibility of those losses. And then if you suffer a casualty loss, it has to be in a federally declared disaster area. Now, if the area is federally declared a disaster area, special rules continue with your IRA folks. So anyone listening in Colorado, we don't have any federally declared disaster areas in Colorado right now, but pay attention, our Colorado listeners, but especially our iTunians, if you are in a federally declared disaster area,
What happens is the 10% early withdrawal penalty that normally applies to IRAs if you take money out of your IRA prior to age 59 and a half, that is gone. So in a federally declared disaster area, you don't have to worry about the 10% early withdrawal penalty. And the income from taking that money out, Chris, a lot of people don't realize this, can be spread out over three tax years. So you don't have to declare it all in one. Mm-hmm. So if you took out $300,000 to start rebuilding your house as you're waiting for the insurance claim to come in, you can just declare $100,000 a year for over the next 3 years. You don't have to declare all $300,000. Or if you take out $100,000, you declare $33,000 or whatever it is. You've got 3 years to spread out the income payments. Mm. Not all at once. But what a lot of people don't know is, let's say you do take $300,000 out of your IRA in these federally declared disaster areas, Chris, to rebuild your home. You can spread out the taxation of that. You are also allowed to pay that money back, to recontribute it, and it's exempt from any contribution limits. And it's exempt from being considered part of that year's contribution.
Wow.
And they allow you to pay it back over 3 years.
Hmm.
So a lot of people don't realize that, but the IRA can end up being used for short-term funding. You're waiting for the insurance claim to come in. Take the money from the IRA. Yes, you're going to have to pay taxes on it, but you can spread it out over 3 years. Then you get your check. When I had my water damage, I got some money up front. Then I had to do repairs, and then I got the last bit of money. You don't get it all at once, Chris. So it could take several years before all this comes in. As the payment monies come in, not only can you direct it back in, you get to deduct it all. Mm-hmm. So you paid taxes on it coming out, but you deduct it all going back in. And the theory behind it is it kind of equals out.
Yeah. Hmm.
So that continues, folks. That's not being impacted. But what is being impacted is if you live in an area that is not declared a federal disaster area, there is no longer a deduction from those losses on your tax return. And if you're robbed, there's no longer a deduction for that. But if you are in a federal disaster area, you can take money out of your IRA, and it's a lot more flexible.
Hmm. Interesting. So we've got a song coming up for you. A song from 1935, as we look back to the start of Social Security. We're going to hear that song after we come back from this short break. We'll also have Junior joining us, who is Justin Fundalinski here from the office. He's going to share some information about the kiddie tax. We had talked about that a week or two ago, and he's got some more tidbits of information on
that. It relates to IRAs.
Yeah. So we'll be back with you after this short break, and we'll hear that song from 1935.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Just one of those things, just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then ring, just one of those things. It was just one of those.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado Edition. That is, of course, Just One of Those Things by Cole Porter.
That was a guy?
Cole Porter wrote it. Lena Horne was singing that version of it. There are several versions. That one just looked good. It was also, it was featured in 1935 in the musical Jubilee. It was later featured in two Doris Day musicals, Lullaby of Broadway in 1951 and Young at Heart in 1954. It was used in the film version of Can Can in 1960. And it was even used, actually the series finale of MASH took the name Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen from a line in this song. So it's had influence over many decades. Cole Porter, he's one of the biggies.
Interesting. Okay. So, I didn't realize MASH got that from there.
Yeah. I didn't either until I just read it. And I don't even know that's the truth of, other than I have to trust Tina.
Fact checker.
Most of these are correct. So I would say I trust that.
Yeah. Okay. Tina's not out to make you look foolish on the radio.
No. So here we are.
Okay.
Oh, and here's Justin.
We have Justin Fundalinski with us.
I am here.
He joined us. He took a little break from the office, figured he'd come in here and record a little section on the kitty tax and how changes to the kitty tax could impact. I gave a little teaser, Justin, how a grandparent passes an IRA on to a grandchild, something that we haven't really talked enough about on this show is what happens when a child does receive an IRA. How is that taxed? So I think we did talk, not necessarily on the Colorado show, so our Colorado listeners haven't heard much, Justin, on the kitty tax, but our iTunians did hear about the kitty tax because I think we had a question on the iTunes show. A
couple weeks ago.
So why don't you explain a little bit to our listeners what the kitty tax is and how under the Republican tax plan, otherwise known as the Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017, we affectionately call it the Republican tax plan, how does the Republican tax plan affect the kitty tax?
Okay, so the kitty tax was originally designed so you can't just offload unearned income to your children and get taxed at very low rates.
And why don't you explain a little bit between what unearned income is and what's earned income? Because this only impacts unearned income.
Right. So obviously you go to work, you have earned income, you earn it, you know, you're earning your wages, you're going to get a W-2, it's going to be in your name. You can't really pass that income off to your children, right? But if it's, say, investment income, you could gift that investment to them over time or fill up an account. And if there's income being generated off of it, it would be taxed at the child's rates. But they've found that loophole and they plugged it with the kitty tax, which essentially used to, if there was unearned income over $2,100, so capital gains or dividends or whatever it may be, also, IRA distributions is something that Jim is talking about here. Those would get taxed at the parental tax rate, the marginal tax rate, so whatever marginal rate they were in. But with this new Jobs and Tax Act under the Republican bill, it is actually changing from the parental tax rate to trust and estate tax rates, which have substantially compressed brackets. But I guess depending on how much income you have, it may benefit people or not.
It could, right. And that was one of the things that Ed Slott pointed out to us, and I'm trying to point out to our listeners, that under the kitty tax, prior to the Tax Cut and Job Act, affectionately known as the Republican tax plan, prior to that, any unearned income above a yearly statutory limit, this year it's $2,100. So the first $2,100 that your child earns, unearned
right.
income, but that he receives or she receives through interest, dividends, rental income, something like that. Does it escape full taxation or is half taxed at one rate, half taxed at another? I forget that rule.
It's escaping it there. So there's nothing being taxed at that point.
Yeah. So if a child has some a mutual fund that someone gifted to them and that mutual fund pays $1,000 interest out or dividend out, the child doesn't pay any tax on
that. Right. And the way I kind of always this thought about it is we get a standard deduction normally or an itemized deduction. That's their little deduction. So as long as it doesn't go above that, then that's just wiped out free.
And that even applies if the parent is taking them as a dependent on their tax return.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. That's how the kitty tax comes about because it is for dependents.
Correct. Right. Okay. So
the first $2,100 that the child receives would be essentially tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the Republican tax plan, any money above that would be taxed at the parent's marginal rate. So the parents could have been in the 15% bracket or the 25% bracket or the 33% tax bracket. And any unearned income received by the child above that $2,100 limit would be subject not to a bracket of its own, Justin, but boom, right to the parent's marginal rate.
The marginal rate, exactly.
Okay. Well, under the Republican tax cut plan, the kiddie tax is now subject to the same, I guess, schedule as trusts. Trusts and estates are taxed at very compressed rates. We will talk the new numbers. After you earn, or after a trust earns $12,500 of income, it will pay taxes at the 37% marginal rate. Used to be 39.6. It is now 37. But it used to be, in the case of, say, a married couple or a single person, in this case, they would have to earn over $400,000 before they would be subject to the 39.6% rule. Now it's been cut to 37%, and they can earn up to $600,000 as a couple, Justin, and stay in that lower, but before they get hit by the higher 37% tax bracket. So I was pretty amazed to see that, because Ed wrote, a married couple can have $600,000 of taxable income before reaching the 37% tax bracket. But a trust reaches that, Justin, at $12,500 of taxable income. Huge disparity, huge difference between the individual marginal rates and the compressed rates for trusts and estates. Now we're going to have to say, Justin, compressed rates for trusts, estates, and kiddie tax. Because now the kiddie tax is saying, if the children earn more than $12,500 of unearned income, they will pay taxes on every dollar above that at 37%. They're going to be hit by the trust tax rates.
Right. They get to exempt the first $2,100.
The first $2,100, yes. But yeah, every dollar above that is hit. So we want to point out a couple of planning, I guess you could say, strategies or cautions, a little bit of both. One's a strategy, one's a caution. Let's look at the strategy first. Let's say the parent is in the, what are the tax brackets now, Justin? It's 12, 22. What's above 22?
24 and jumps to 32, I think. I don't have them memorized at this point. I haven't worked with them yet.
Oh, okay. Do you know them offhand?
I just read them several times.
I do not.
You do not. Justin's going to look them up, listeners, on his handy-dandy Google iPhone. But, no, you don't have an iPhone. You got one of those Samsung things, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Justin's going to look up what the current tax rates are. But let's pretend a person is in the, I think it's, what's below the 37? Is it the 34? Did you find the damn brackets yet?
I've just hit search. We've got them. Let's see. So it'd be the 35.
35.
Just below it, yep.
So it goes 37, 35. What's below 35?
Still loading. It's, I just got partial image, so give me a second here.
Wow, you got some slow internet here going on.
Hey, this is your Wi-Fi, okay?
I know. So this room is terrible, Mr. Tech Guy.
I never have a problem.
For Wi-Fi in here.
It's coming. It's coming. So we got 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and 37.
That's a lot of brackets.
That's a lot of brackets.
Oh, they didn't compress the number of brackets at all. It's the same number of brackets.
Seven brackets.
Yes.
Okay, so let's say, listeners, you have parents in the 32% tax bracket. The compressed rates for trusts, we always say, Chris, more than $12,500, trust is going to now pay 37% taxes. But what people don't pay attention to is what happens below $12,500. Well, the compressed brackets, there are fewer brackets. There's only four brackets in the compressed tax rates for trusts. And it begins with the first $2,550 of trust income is taxed at 10%. Mm-hmm. So what Ed is saying, follow his logic here. Under the new rules, under the old rules, every dollar above $2,100 was taxed at the parent's marginal rate. Under the old rules, if you were being taxed at 32, you were actually in the old 35. Or was it 35 or 36 back then? I can't even remember last year's tax rates.
That was 3 weeks ago.
That was last year, though.
Actually, you're still operating under them until...
Well, Justin does taxes. So if you're in the new 32, what were you in the past?
Well, they've changed. It depends on where you are in the 32.
They've changed the dollar amounts of the brackets, too.
So you can't just
change the rate.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's just say you used to be in the 33 bracket. You're now in the 32.
Fair enough.
Earning $1 more than $2,100, your child would have to pay 33% taxes on that. Mm-hmm. But under the new rule, the first $2,550 is taxed at just 10%. So what Ed is saying is your child could actually have about $116,000 in investments, earning 4%, and under the new kiddie tax, only pay 10% taxes on that. How did he come up with that? The first $2,100 is exempt from any income taxes. The next $2,550 is subject to a 10% tax. But under the old kiddie tax rule, that $2,550 would have been subject to a 33% tax. And then he goes so further as to saying you could up it to $365,000 in the name of your child. If it was earning 4%, they could earn up to that much and still pay less than having to pay at the highest marginal rate of 37. Mm-hmm. So what he's trying to get people to do, and I know you want to add to something, Justin, on this, is to get people to look at the bracket that the parents are in and the interest rate of the investment, and it might make sense to still put it on the child's tax return.
I will say, I didn't read too much into this right now, but he is focusing substantially in this article on interest rather than capital gains and dividends, which have a special tax treatment.
Correct.
So it may not be as drastic as he makes it out to be, especially because if you can find something that just pays out 4% interest, that'd be fantastic.
Sure.
So
I think the point he's trying to make is to think about some of this.
Exactly.
That under this, initially, the first few thousand dollars your child is going to earn above $2,100 is coming out better under this Republican tax plan than the old rules under the kiddie tax.
If it is interest. And my point on that one is, if you didn't, say, gift it to your child, and you were below the highest marginal bracket, you know, you'd probably only be paying 15% on dividends or capital gains. But if you were on the lower levels of it, you know, the 0, 10, 12, you don't pay anything at all. So you got to really know exactly what type of income is going to be pulled off of this investment before you make any decisions. You
Absolutely.
Certainly can't jump into it. I think it works in some cases, doesn't work in others.
But the big thing he wanted to point out as it relates to IRAs that a lot of people don't factor in, and we jokingly teased our listeners, Chris, at the beginning, might make grandparents rethink how they give money or leave their IRA to their grandkids. Distributions, all distributions from an IRA is unearned income subject to the kiddie tax if paid to a child. The entire distribution, the entire RMD. And it's important to understand, listeners, that even if the grandchild is 10 years old, required minimum distributions when a non-spouse beneficiary inherits an IRA begin the year after the IRA owner's death. So there's no waiting until the child turns 70 and a half for an inherited IRA. Required minimum distributions will begin right away. Now, granted, a 10-year-old, the IRA would have to be quite substantial to generate a $12,500, because every dollar above $12,500 would be subject to 37% taxes to the child. Every dollar every dollar above $12,500 would be subject to 37% taxes. Every dollar from the IRA, every dollar of that RMD is part of that, though. But in order for that, I don't have the single life table in front of me. I should have. But you would have to probably have north of $1 million left to this child in order to generate a $12,500 RMD. So it's not necessarily his point, the RMDs that's going to turn this. But what if you even leave $50,000 to a child? And that child is 16, 17 years old and wants to take $30,000 out to buy his or her first car. That $30,000 distribution, every dollar above $12,500, 37% of it is now lost to the government in taxes under this new kiddie tax provision, even if the child has no job. This is the only distribution coming out. 37% of every dollar above $12,500 is going to be lost to the kiddie tax. And the first $12,500 is not tax-free. It's just that the first $2,500 is taxed at 10%, the next $9,000 is taxed at 24%, and between $9,000 and $12,500 is taxed at 35%. I haven't figured out what the effective rate of all that is, but my mind is telling me probably somewhere around 20%. So the first $12,500, about 20% of it is lost, and then every dollar above $12,500, the kid's going to lose 37% of it.
Something related to this, though, to keep in mind is once they've reached, in the year they turn 17, a lot of this changes because there's no reason for a 17-year-old.
Unless they're a full-time student.
There's no reason for a 17-year-old to continue. What do you mean, not unless they're a full-time student?
The kiddie tax will apply up to age 24 if they're a full-time college student.
Even if they are not being claimed as a dependent?
It depends. So it's
no pun intended,
full-time student who is at least 19 and under the age of 24, mm-hmm. and that's at the end of the tax year, and the child's earned income doesn't exceed one half of the child's own support. So if they're earning money of their own,
right,
it could affect it.
Once they earn more than half, then they're not considered a dependent anymore. If they're not. But right. the reason I mentioned that earned,
the IRA distribution won't be earned.
I understand. Okay. They probably have a job at that point.
One would hope, but not necessarily.
Back in the day, back when there were actually personal exemptions, those kids would be claimed on their as dependents on their parents' tax returns. That attraction is now gone under the new tax rules because there's no such thing as a personal exemption anymore.
That's true.
And once they turn 17, there's no longer the child tax credit.
Right.
So having a 17, 18, 19-year-old with a job on your tax return as a parent may not be happening anymore.
Right.
So what Chris there's another piece to this puzzle.
Correct. What Chris is saying is the kiddie tax may not apply to the child after that, but it will definitely apply to the child at 14, 15, 16. Yep. And what I'm trying to point out and what Ed was trying to point out under this, grandparents who leave, it doesn't have to be a $1 million IRA with an RMD above $12,500. You can leave your grandchild $20,000 in an IRA. That grandchild is most likely going to close that IRA and just take the $20,000 out. And they're going to lose a good chunk of it to the kiddie tax. That's his point. When you start leaving money to children in IRAs, grandparents, just be aware that a lot of it's going to be lost to the kiddie tax. So he said, and I agree with him wholeheartedly, it adds a new twist to conversions. Maybe the grandparents can convert some at a 15% tax bracket to leave it, or whatever the new 12% bracket now, to leave $20,000 or $30,000 eventually to a child in a Roth IRA where none of it will be lost to any taxes. So a little bit of tax planning on these small IRAs that grandparents want to leave to children or grandchildren is very important. That's what he's trying to say under this new.
So a number of these things have changed. So we need to you need to relook at it. If that was part of your plan, you were thinking of doing this. The rules now are different, and you need to factor that into your decision making because there might be a better strategy.
Now, why don't you clear this up a little bit for me? If a child inherits money, obviously they don't have any real control over that money, and they're custodian or their parent, you know,
a custodial IRA would be open.
So they would be able to determine whether or not it's time to take money out of it and hopefully make the correct decisions for the child. Now's not the time to
buy a
car.
But try telling a 16-year-old, no, you can't buy the car right now because of the kiddie tax that's going to impact your money. The kid might be, I want this car.
Well, too bad.
I'm
your parent.
I'm just saying.
Go to your room.
And get off my lawn.
Yeah.
But it's a unique, it doesn't impact everyone, but there are a lot of grandparents who leave $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 IRAs to their grandkids thinking, okay, the grandchild is in a low bracket, they're not paying attention to the kiddie tax, they're thinking they can take this money out. But all distributions from the IRA are subject to the kiddie tax. They are considered unearned income. So I'm just curious, if a distribution from an IRA, Justin, is kiddie tax, interest is kiddie tax, you said dividends and capital gains are not. So how are they taxed?
No, they would be. They
but
are
a different rate.
No, they're taxed at, well, I'll have to look at this new law, but the way it used to be, it was at the marginal rate.
So why were you saying paying attention to 4% interest?
If it was in the kid's name. If it's in your name, then you have those special
taxes. Got you. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. Because Ed was saying you may want to transfer some assets to the child, have the interest earned. I see where you're going with that. Okay.
Right.
So it's just a little bit of the way the Tax Cut and Job Act of 2017 are impacting IRAs. And I just wanted our listeners to get a little bit out of that there's still some planning opportunities here to pay attention. Some things have lost, some things have gained, some things are better, some things are worse. But the kiddie tax, to me, it really impacts small IRAs you want to leave to your grandkids. Be very careful, grandparents.
So that music means we're at the end of another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. Please reach out to us if you have any questions on any of our retirement topics. Best way to do that is at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. We're happy to answer your questions there. Until next week, we'll see you next time here on the Retirement and IRA Show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.